State and Federal Affairs, State and Federal Affairs Full Committee meeting Monday, March 29th, Room 105, on House Bill 1420, House Bill 1515, House Bill 1523, House Bill 1524, Senate Bill 57, HJM 12, SJR 7, Senate Bill 61, House Bill 1717, House Bill 1721, House Bill 1136, House Bill 1279, House Bill 1452.
House Committee on State and Federal Affairs will come to order. The clerk will note the members present and those detained. We have two bills. Before we get into anything that's going to be controversial, we have two bills that are here, House Bill 1717 and House Bill 1729 from the Committee on Governmental Reorganization, which are being suggested referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, those are employee retirement bills, and they would have to go to Ways and Means sooner or later, and we thought it was a waste of the committee's time when they'd have to have two hearings on them, so we thought they just better go down there.
All right, so moved.
All right. Representative Ingalls.
With no recommendation.
Moves House Bill 1717 and House Bill 1721 be sent to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Any discussion?
Question.
Questions called for on referral of 1721 and 1717.
Whether or not they can be funded.
That'll teach you when I'm late.
They're public employee retirement bills, and they always got involved whether or not the retirement fund can or will.
1717, 1721. In other words, they're not Ways and Means bills with prior reference.
No,
no. But they are bills that would definitely affect the retirement.
We could have hearing on them and pass them out okay, and they could say no, so.
And they'll say no or yes anyway.
They'll say no or yes anyway. They don't set policy, I understand. They say yes or no.
I know.
They have a policy of just saying yes or no.
Huh?
They just have a policy of saying yes.
Yeah, or no. 2-5, they overruled. Bill was passed 41-17 in the last session. We ready to vote? Questions called for. Clerk call roll. We're sending 1717 and 1721 to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Clerk call roll.
Aye.
Cole.
No.
Dinsmore.
No.
Howard. Ingalls.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
No.
McPherson.
Chairman, I'll change my vote to aye.
Yeah, you already recorded that way. I'm glad you did.
This was on that effort. Patterson.
Aye.
Stafford.
Aye.
Dulles.
Aye.
Martin.
Aye.
So ordered. Let's turn to House Bill 1420. And someone's going to explain this. He's not here, so it was me. This is a bill to request of the Corrections Division, which requires release of prisoners. You can see the front page says it basically just lets the prisoners out before a holiday or a Saturday or Sunday. It's going to have a minimal effect on a man's sentence and might get him out of jail or prison a couple days early. State Federal.
Yes. I would move that House Bill 1420 be returned to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
Representative Cole moves House Bill 1420 back to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
The reason is that they appear to create a problem here where the court allows prisoners to serve jail sentence over a weekend. We have many instances where...
George, I can't hear you, Doug.
Yeah, we have many instances where... Court, particularly the district court, will give a guy 10-day sentence or a 7-day sentence and allow him to serve it on weekends, so he won't interrupt his work. And we just passed a bill out of judiciary that puts a mandatory 6-day jail sentence on those convicted of driving under the influence, with a specific provision in there that it can be served on weekends if the defendant requests. And it would appear in reading this bill that he would be unable to serve weekends because it provides that he's released on Friday if at any time if his day of release would fall on a Saturday or a Sunday, which would be the case on the weekend sentence. So it would be my suggestion that he return to committee to insert a provision that would permit service of jail sentences on weekends, or at least exempt that situation from the bill.
Is there any objection to returning it to committee?
I'm not sure if the problem is the man is sentenced to 6 days in jail and he's allowed to serve them on the weekend. His term would be up after the 6 days are served.
His term would be up Sunday of the second weekend, which means he'd be released on Friday.
Is there any objection to sending it back?
If not, it's so ordered by unanimous consent.
House Bill 1515. House Bill 1515 is a newspaper advertising bill which increases the rate for legal publications.
You carry the bill, Bob?
By 1 penny per column inch. We had considerable testimony on behalf of the bill from newspaper people who point out that the rates for everything and the costs have gone up like 50% to 75% since this was last changed, which I believe is about 10 years ago. And fiscally, or from an economic viewpoint, they point out they can quite easily justify the need for the penny increase. Both the cities and counties indicated no great dissatisfaction of their concern, and in another bill they're trying to get rid of the requirement that they publish, the counties especially publish a long expenditure thing, and that of course has nothing to do with this particular item. Mr. Patterson.
Yes. I noticed that you limit this to newspapers having a circulation of over 40,000. Just a question, is there a limitation, is there a set fee for those having circulation under 40,000?
I can't answer.
Yes.
There's
another law that pertains to those?
This pertains only to legals, as you probably know, and there's a different rate for over and under 40,000. I thought that was included in this bill.
You read down, Mr. Chairman. Subsection 1, change from 4 to 5 cents. The publication of having more than 40,000, go down.
I think that takes care of the other one, that A and those two.
Could I ask Mr. Ingalls a question?
Go ahead.
What's the difference in per column inch as opposed to per column line?
Column inch is the depth, takes about 7 lines to the inch, and the line, of course, is charged by the line.
Well, like on line 10, you're changing the rate from 4 to 5 cents per column inch.
Well, some are charged by the column inch rather than by the line. Is the problem here? I assume these over 40,000 people are charged for the column inch, and the little people are charging by, we little people are charging by the line.
And would that justify then one increase in 5 cents as opposed to the other only increase in 1 cent?
Well, what you're actually doing, if my mathematics is right, is giving them 35 cents a column inch more down below, and it's like 1 cent a column inch up above, if that's right.
I don't think that's right.
For 1,000 approved circulation.
Yeah.
I think you have to have 40,000 for anything in that subsection.
Not subsection A of two, I don't think.
Guess we can get the book out in a month.
You got too practical.
Talking in that second section about county official papers, which means the weeklies and others, and they usually charge by the line. The big city dailies probably are charging by the inch on these things.
Maybe we could ask the member of the press.
Well, I...
Roger, who testified on this?
Oh, we had...
Ingles.
No, you didn't.
We had a whole series.
Are the minutes up to date on this, or so we can take a look at this?
See, Webb testified on it, Phil Bladeen.
Well, he wouldn't explain the one point they're talking about. But Phil Bladeen, four or five small papers was one of the main testifiers.
Well, papers don't, that's right.
What?
Papers did not approve.
They're in favor.
They're in favor of it.
I remember now. I think lines 12 and 13 take care of the exception.
Yeah, it does. Question?
Representative Anderson, well, we're gonna get a motion first. Representative Anderson moves House Bill 1515 to the floor with due pass recommendation. And Representative Kennedy calls the question. Call the roll.
Anderson.
Aye.
Alcorn.
Aye.
Cole.
Aye.
Dinsmore.
Aye.
Howard.
Aye.
Ingles.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Stathis. Stoltz.
Aye. Aye. So ordered, and, Should give it to him. Quite fair. Let's get to the action. Friendly members of the press can do what they want to do in late. Turn to SJR 7. Senate Joint Resolution Number 7. Representative Johnson.
We also felt that this should be referred to the people to let them express their views on the 18-year-old vote at the next primary election, which would be in 1972.
Make a motion.
I would move this to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves Senate Joint Resolution Number 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Cole.
Ask Representative Johnson a question. As I understand, this bill came out of the Senate before the action of Congress took place in regards to the amendment. Is there any discussion in committee in regards to amending this resolution to provide for a vehicle for the legislature to consider the ratification of that amendment?
Not on this.
No discussion.
Was there any discussion in committee in regards to the ratification as opposed to...
Not on this bill, no.
On any bill? As an alternative?
Yeah, on several bills, but not on SJR 7.
Committee considering a bill now to put that proposition before the legislature?
No, they're not.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator O'Connor?
Representative Johnson, elaborate on that. Why not? I mean, the legislature does have the opportunity to ratify. I think it's, for my part in the case, I think it's, we have two opportunities to try to eliminate a ridiculous dual voting system, and I think that we ought to move on perhaps both fronts. And why not, if there was a discussion, why not?
Well, I'm certain that your comments are well respected, Representative O'Connor. It was the feeling of the committee that the voters expressed how they felt about the 19-year-old vote. We also recognize that there has been some changes. We don't recognize the fact that maybe the voters in the state might have changed their minds. We also recognize the fact that the voters in the state might not really appreciate getting the ramrodded down their throat. So our feeling was that we should refer this to the people and let those people within the state and voting residents decide what they wanted to do with the 18-year-old vote. They very much expressed their feeling at the last election, and we felt that it was not our responsibility to extend the same thing all over, go contrary to what they did express. And it was our feeling that this, they should once again, through the vote, have the opportunity to express their feeling if they wanted this or not.
Mr. Chairman, a lot of water has gone under the bridge since that election. I think every member of the committee ought to recognize that. And also, 38 states ratified this thing. The people of Oregon are going to have an 18-year-old vote, whether or not they vote on it in the state or not. I think to ignore those things is to ignore a real salient feature of the arguments.
I'm going to get on the discussion, Tom.
You're the chairman.
That's a good
way to get the camera.
Wait to get the camera. That's one point. The other, of course, the water under the bridge is all federal water. And as far as I'm concerned, the people of the state of Oregon ought to make this decision, not our friends in Congress. And I don't particularly care what our friends in Congress are trying to dictate throughout the United States. I think the Oregon voters ought to be the ones to change our Constitution. And it happens to be that the voting age is in our Constitution. And if the voters so choose, that's fine. I don't see ratification. If our voters were to vote no on the 18-year-old vote, ratification would be partially shoving it down their throat and also help to shove it down the throats of a lot of other states. And I don't think I should be making, or we should be making a decision for Montana or a lot of other states. That's, as far as I'm concerned, a state issue. Representative Densmore.
Chairman, I move that House Joint Resolution 7 be referred to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
Representative Densmore moves SGR 7 be returned to the, or be sent to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
Standing Subcommittee.
Sent to the Standing Subcommittee, State and Federal Affairs. Some discussion.
I'd like to speak on that.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the United States Constitution provides that it may be amended in one of two ways. One way is the action of the state legislatures, and the other way is the state constitutional convention. I think when such an amendment is sent out by the federal Congress, it is a responsibility, it is indeed the obligation of the legislature to stand up and be counted on that amendment. Yes or no? Do we favor it or do we not favor it? I think that we should send this joint resolution, the vehicle that we have, to the State Federal Affairs Subcommittee to provide that vehicle and have it amended in that way. Provide for the ratification.
Did you have felt the same way in the Dirksen memo?
Yes, sir.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I feel very strongly, and to reiterate what Representative Johnson said, I feel very strongly if the circumstances were different. For instance, if we hadn't voted on the 19-year-old vote last year, certainly I would take the position that Representative Densmore had. But under the conditions, times have changed, situations have changed. We don't have a handle or any special insight that the voters of Oregon do not have. I think we owe it to them, and rather than flaunt our authority in their face and go ahead and ratify this constitutional amendment that the Congress sends to us, I think we owe it to them to present it back to them. They have full understanding that the circumstances have changed, that the United States, actions of the United States Congress have taken place, that there is a change in attitude among young people and older people alike, and we owe it to them to let them vote on this amendment.
Call for questions.
Questions called for. This is on vote to refer to the State Federal Affairs Committee. The clerk will call the roll.
Anderson.
No.
Alcorn.
Aye.
Toll.
Aye.
Densmore.
Aye.
Howard.
Aye.
Engel.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Kennedy.
Aye.
McPherson.
No.
Patterson.
No.
Bassett.
Aye.
Toll.
No.
Martin.
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Densmore, why do you want to slow this up to 11:06?
Motion fails.
Chairman?
Mr. Chairman? Kennedy.
I would now ask unanimous consent of the committee to amend HJR 7 on page 2 of the printed resolution after line 1. Delete line 1 through 34. And insert, quote, whereas Senate Joint Resolution of the 92nd Congress, parenthesis, first session, parenthesis, of the United States of America, proposes an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, comma, as follows. Article 26, section 1, the right of citizens of the United States, comma, who are 18 years of age or older, comma, to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age, period. Section 2, the Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation, and whereas the proposed amendment shall be valid for all intents and purposes part of the Constitution of the United States when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission by the Congress, now therefore, let me delete at this point lines 3 through 33 and insert the proposed amendment to the Constitution of the United States, comma, relating to the right of citizens of the United States, comma, who are 18 years of age or older, comma, to vote as set forth in this resolution hereby is ratified. Subsection 2, Secretary of State shall send certified copies of this resolution to the Administrator of General Services of the United States, comma, the Presiding Officer of the United States Senate, to the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States.
Objection. Representative McPherson objects. Unanimous consent.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative McPherson?
Do I understand that then that it is the position then of the Democratic members of this committee that we should, as I gathered from the first vote that we took, which was a party line vote?
No, it wasn't a party line vote.
Well, stand corrected.
All right, I'll stand corrected by one. But I've gathered just from the speeches that have been made, Bill, that Democratic members of the committee feel that we should deny the Oregon voters the right to vote on this issue once they spoke so recently on the matter in 1970, that we should just rush in and ratify the congressional enactment which lets these 18-year-olds vote in local elections. Now, if that is the position of the Democratic members of this committee, then I think it should be made known that apparently the Republican position is and will be that voters should have the opportunity to once again vote on this matter. And for that reason, I'll move SJR 7 that has been amended.
Well, we've already had an amendment.
I'll move the question.
Chairman. Representative Kennedy.
I think that the response is in order. Several days ago, I attempted through another resolution to separate these two issues because there really are two issues at hand. One is a proposal to amend the Constitution of the State of Oregon. Another is to exercise our responsibilities in considering the ratification of a constitutional amendment proposed to us by the federal Congress, and they are separate issues. this attempt to separate these two issues was denied this committee by the Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization, because they are two issues. For that reason, you're taking this approach, not on a partisan basis, but on the basis that, that this legislature has the responsibility to act on both issues. We have a responsibility to act on the congressional amendment. How people, once this issue reaches the floor, vote is a matter of their own judgment. I don't believe that the fact that the 19-year-old vote was defeated by Oregon citizens is a particular relevancy to this issue. Because the fact that there are two legitimate issues at hand. I hope that it will be my intention, if the motion to send us to the floor passes, it will be my intention to file a minority report with the hopes that a number of the other members of the committee will join me to place this issue before the House. And with that, I'll stop.
The chair wants to make a point. One of the rules we adopted was that the chairman could introduce any legislation. We felt pertinent to the subject as a committee bill, and those committee bills are still here. We are still able to introduce them. I will be quite happy to introduce that printed amendments as a committee bill, if you would so like to have it considered, because as you pointed out, it is a separate issue.
Well, if the minority report is defeated on the floor, I would certainly appreciate that opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
If Mr. Kennedy does not care to follow the correct route, which should be to introduce a bill through a committee and hold hearings, he suggests he'd rather go to the floor with this. If that would fail, I would suggest this committee should vote on introducing that resolution.
I wanted to comment, Mr. Chairman, that I supported the 19-year-old vote for the people last time, and I'm sure other members of my party did also. I'm disappointed with the decision of the people, but I can like living in a democracy, and I'm perfectly willing to abide to the decision of the majority. I feel that the voters, having spoken on this, should be entitled to again express their preference.
Chairman, I might say that I was the deciding vote last year by changing my vote. The only way they could get that bill out of committee 2 years ago was for me to change my vote. I opposed 18-year-old voting, I opposed 19-year-old voting at that time. But I did change my vote. It went to the vote of the people, and they defeated it. I don't think that we have any control over it. When the Congress of the United States says that 18-year-olds are allowed to vote. And I think that now, 2 years ago, was a different situation. I think now we should stand up and be counted. The Congress has moved, and I know that we say, don't do what Congress does, but here we've been passing memorials like mad out here, wanting them to take over revenue sharing. One time they're a terrible entity back there, and the next time they become a real old father. I think that we should stand up and be counted and pass this resolution and allow 18-year-olds to vote.
Representative McPherson?
Wonder if President Kennedy would yield to question or two.
Well, I'd be most pleased to, Mr. President. As long as you don't violate the rule that you quoted this morning.
I would never do that, except we happen to be in committee right now. You say we have a responsibility on this matter to act, and I think Representative Densmore said we have a responsibility to express ourselves one way or another, either for it or against it. Would you be willing to tell me how a legislative body expresses themselves in opposition to the ratification?
By voting no on the ratification on the floor. You will have an opportunity to vote against it by voting against the minority report.
So how would it ever become for the body if it
home of the majority report if it could never get out of the committee, if the majority was against it.
I don't understand the question.
Well, if the majority of the members of the legislature are against the matter, against the ratification, how is it ever going to get on the floor for a vote?
Well, if this committee decides that, are you speaking of the minority report?
No, there can be no minority report without a majority report.
I intend to support the, need my vote to get the SJR 7 out. Mr. Pearson, if you're short on votes, I'll be happy to cooperate.
I'm merely, you can count as well as I can, Mr. Kennedy. I'm merely asking you, what does the state do in that instance that they don't want to ratify? Did they pass a resolution saying we don't want to ratify?
Well, you vote against them, you vote against the amendment.
You vote against what?
The resolution.
Well, it might be a little difficult to do, Mr. Kennedy.
Well, we'll see. Further questions?
Shall we vote?
Mr. Chairman, just a point of order here. Will somebody please tell me what other thing that we might be voting on, and what would be the mechanics of us being in a position to vote on it? I don't comprehend.
I suggested that what I would be happy to do, because the chairman has the prerogative, is to introduce the language for ratification that Representative Kennedy just read as a committee bill, which would then enable us to consider both subjects separately, since I think it was pointed out aptly that they are separate subjects, and not have to debate one against the other, which is what we'll have to do if Representative Kennedy calls through his voice on it. I think that we ought to debate both as separate issues. It was editorialized in the Oregonian this morning or recently. They are separate and distinct issues. They should both be considered.
Now, if this is introduced as a committee bill, what committee would it come before?
Well, it would be had the speaker sign the bill, but I'd be quite happy to suggest that he send it to state and federal affairs. Probably come.
To rule.
Are we ready for the question? Question? Yes, SJR.
To the floor with a unanimous recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Anderson? Offline?
No.
Cole?
No.
Benmore?
No.
Howard?
No.
Ingalls?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kennedy?
No.
McPherson?
Aye.
Patterson?
Aye.
Bassett?
Aye.
Stoltz?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
So, and then Johnson, carry it on the floor. And are you going to file a minority report?
Yes, sir.
Representative Kennedy will file a minority report. Subject. Would you give her the mechanics of how that's going to?
Yep.
Well, you do it yourself, I guess. Should be happy to prepare it for you. Wouldn't you? House Bill 1523, Representative Stafford. Call him. Let's adjourn right now. We've had five bills. We have a work session tomorrow at 1 o'clock, so the whole committee stands adjourned.
We're
going to
be in room 20.
Subcommittee will
State Federal Affairs Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization, Monday, March 29th, on House Bill 1062.
Subcommittee on Government Reorganization will come to order. We're hearing House Bill 1062. We have a large number of people who have signed up to testify on this bill, and I'm going, except for the introduction and explanation of the bill, I'm going to call on the out-of-state people before, out-of-town people before I call on the Salem people, because I hate to have them come down twice. And the Salem people, I presume, can come almost any time. So we'll get the Portland and other out-of-city people today, and ask the Salem people to come back day after tomorrow when we have another hearing on it. We'll start off, though, with Jim Falstead.
the governor's office.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Falstich. I'm assistant to the governor for economic development and consumer services, and I am here today to speak in support of House Bill 1062 and urge your favorable consideration. Without going into any great detail in the bill, what it does do is place all the remaining occupational licensing boards and divisions within the Department of Commerce. In 1963, the Oregon legislature adopted the concept of a Department of Commerce with the occupational licensing boards within that department. Since that time, many departments and boards have been included within the Department of Commerce. This picks up the remaining such boards and divisions, except for those boards and divisions that are health related. In other words, we're talking about occupational licensing in this bill. Three things would be accomplished by so coordinating the occupational licensing functions of the state of Oregon. The first and most important thing that would be accomplished is to provide greater protection to the consuming public of this state through proper and direct supervision of the activities of these boards and divisions. The second thing that would be so accomplished by the grouping together of these agencies is that common procedures and techniques can be evolved for the better administration of these quite similar licensing functions. The third thing that would be so achieved is that you would have a uniform response on consumer problems and matters through this coordination of these occupational licensing functions. In addition to establishing the Department of Commerce, or within the Department of Commerce, the occupational licensing boards, the bill also establishes a consumer services division within the department, which would be a new division. About a year and a half ago, Governor Tom McCall created an ad hoc consumer services committee, which was charged by him with the responsibility to be responsive to all consumer complaints, whether or not they fell within the jurisdiction of existing state agencies. This was done on a voluntary basis on the part of the agencies involved, and working in the evening and on weekends, they have been responsive since that time to approximately 1,000 complaints, over 80% of which have been resolved to the satisfaction of the consumer. In addition to resolving individual consumer complaints, this Consumer Services Task Force and the Consumer Services Division as contemplated in this bill would also serve as a coordination mechanism for consumer services provided by state government generally, and would also serve as a basis for analyzing what further administrative or legislative change is indicated based on the total number of consumer complaints so received. By creating a division within state government charged with this responsibility, we will, for the first time, have a focal point for consumer complaints and grievances in the state of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the bill. There are some minor amendments that Mr. Moore has prepared to the bill, the most significant of which would establish an operative date of January of next year for the Consumer Services Division, or July of this year, I'm sorry, so that there will be no break in the continuity of the service already provided to the consumers of our state. I'd be pleased to answer any questions that the committee may have with respect to this bill.
Mr. Falstich, is there now an accounting for all the fees paid for licensing in the state? So do we know if this will render all these licensing boards operative, self-sustained?
Yes, there is an accounting currently. It is my information that these boards are presently self-sustaining. There are various bills in to modify the fee structures of these various agencies to make sure that they will continue to be self-sustaining this next biennium.
Thank you.
That's my only question.
Lee?
Jim, we've had considerable complaint from the funeral directors that they want to be included out. Do you have any, they would prefer to be in the Board of Health. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, yes, I suppose I do. I have worked closely with the funeral directors since being appointed to this current position by the governor. And it would seem to me that their similarities are closer akin to the other occupational licensing boards already in the Department of Commerce than they would be with the occupational licensing boards, the professional licensing boards proposed for the Division of Health.
Would you say it was too late by the time they... Never mind. At the present time, contractors and other people have to go to several different places to get their electrical, their plumbing, and other matters okayed. Would it be possible within this Department of Commerce to create a Department of Construction, or whatever you want to call it, and put all these things into one agency so a contractor, whoever is building, can only need to come only to one place and get all these things okayed?
Be no problem at all to do that, Representative Ingalls. The present authority in the department, in the director of the department, is to structure his department to give the best service to the public. Now, if he found that some type of, for example, uniform license type thing with uniform application information would be helpful to these people, he could provide for it.
Yes. Thank you very much, Jim. Mr. Ludeman.
Chairman.
Ludeman.
Members of the committee, my name is Tillman Ludeman, and I'm the director of the Department of Commerce. And I'm here, merely, Mr. Chairman, to say that if this bill passes, why, we can administer the bill without any additional cost. Now, I know that sounds unreal and unrealistic, but it's a fact. We have 14 units now in the Department of Commerce. And adding 11 more wouldn't change the general philosophy of operating the department. I've used the expression two or three times, and I admit I've been quoted, but I can't think of any better way to express or illustrate my point than by saying it's like a 10-ton truck going down the highway carrying only 5 tons. Now, I don't mean to say we're not busy over there, but I mean that structure is there to use with very little, if any, extra cost. We, of those 14 units that we have, each one operates autonomously. I've used this expression too, and I'll use it again. The Director of Commerce, in using this philosophy, is like a holding company. He has the appointed authority, he has the responsibility of seeing that everything goes right. In this case, he places the responsibility on the heads of each unit to hold them responsibly for carrying out their duties. They like it better that way, to get better response, and the public likes it better that way. Remember, the public comes in to the Commerce Building and wants to see has some problem about banking, he goes direct to the bank. Has an insurance problem, he goes direct to the insurance department. The alternative would be to steer him into the director's office, under which conditions we'd have to have several deputies and staff of stenographers. We don't have that. I operate this department and have now since July 1, 1964, with myself and a secretary. by placing responsibility, taking people to detail away from my office. If we should get these 11 more departments or agencies, we would go ahead doing the same thing as we're doing now. The director would do the coordinating. That would make 25 departments, 14 and 11. The director would follow the same policy of coordinating the heads around his table. We have frequent meetings where we discuss all of our problems. The governor's office would deal with one person, namely the director, instead of 25 people. That is, if they were all reporting to him. The other point of coordination, in addition to the director's office, would be that of the director of central services, which was created by order of the director in the early beginnings of the department. And Mr. Ernie Moore, who will testify later, is the head of that department. was with the finance department, was our analyst, and he understands budgets and bookkeeping very thoroughly. Now, that point of coordination would coordinate these 25 units in bookkeeping. It would be standard bookkeeping, the same as we have now, standard practices. One budget idea, if I may use the expression, rides herd on budgets. He is an expert in data processing and all its systems. Now, so there'd be two points of coordination, the director's office, the top people, and the central services office under Mr. Moore. Now, I don't want to, I know you're busy today, and I don't want to take any more time, Mr. Chairman, except to say that in Commerce, the Commerce Department today is recognized as the single agency in state government to regulate business. And I would hope that eventually that all units, whether they're boards or divisions, if they're related to business, I would hope that they would be concentrated in the Department of Commerce, not only because I think we can do it efficiently, but I'm sure that it is for the convenience of the public to come to one place and transact their business there, as it is now in the Commerce Building. We're a happy family over there, and Mr. Chairman, we would welcome these 11 units to come into us. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ludeman. Do they ask?
Mr. Ludeman, you indicated that you see your department's main objective is regulating business. Do you also see your department as being a consumer protection oriented type organization?
Yes, as Mr. Foster said, under the order of the governor, there is a committee which was appointed January 15, 1970, consisting of the Public Utilities Commissioner, Mr. Haley, Director of Agriculture, and myself, to coordinate consumer complaints. Those three were named because we handle probably most of the complaints. I happen to be chairman of that committee, and as Mr. Falsick said, we've handled over 1,000 complaints. We've settled over 80% of them satisfactorily, just by calling them on the phone letters. And to answer your question, sir, I would say that bill passes, the administrator of consumer services belongs right around our table with the insurance commissioner. He has something like 20 complaints a day. The real estate commissioner is with us. The superintendent of banks, corporation commissioner. And all of those men are regulating business every day of the year. And so certainly the administrator of consumer services belongs right around our table and would be of
peak of stature, he would be a division head in our department. And now you understand, sir, there's no duplication. If a complaint comes in, say, for about insurance, that claim goes directly to the insurance commissioner because he has the statutes to back him up. This committee that we're talking about is one where there are now no statutes to cover, and the governor is trying to avoid people from getting a letter and say, sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. We never give an answer of that sort. We always do something for them. And I think I've answered your question. I believe that department wrongs and the department covers.
So you, if
the only other place, sir, would be, I said the only other place. There are other places that believe that we have the majority of the regulatory powers right there.
So if we incorporate these other 11 units, most of the citizens of Oregon, if they had a complaint as far as consumer services is concerned, would be able to call the Department of Commerce, and their questions undoubtedly would be able to be answered in 99% of the cases.
That is correct.
Yes. One other question, Mr. Chairman. Would you incorporate the present licensing boards in that exist now under these different jurisdictions? Would the same personnel be incorporated? Or what is your intent along those lines?
Well, we have now, sir, 10 licensing boards. In addition, may I just read these? Our four main divisions are banking, corporation, insurance, and real estate. And in addition to that, we have 10 licensing boards, all related to business: collection agencies, watchmakers, pilots, real estate board, banking board, accountants, architects, auctioneers, engineers, and landscape architects. Now, if the bill passed, we would have two more divisions. I call them divisions. One is the consumer services division, and the other is the fire marshal. And in addition to that, we would have 9 licensing boards. We have barbers, cosmetic people, electricians, funeral director, hearing aid, plumbers, elevators, amusements, and boilers. Now, to answer your question, sir, it would be my plan to have those boards a division of licensing boards in the Department of Commerce at my own direction. It wouldn't be a statute. But I would have meetings, however, with everybody around our conference table. But in the work sessions, I would divide I would have the licensing boards meet separately, all of them, and I would have the banking, corporation, insurance, real estate, consumer service, and fire marshal meet too. But I'll emphasize again, I'm a great leader in coordination. At least once a month, I'd have everybody around in our conference room to discuss the problems with the fire department. I break it up in smaller groups. Right now, sir, those 11 new units that are in this bill, there's 1062. Now, out of the 11, 5 report to the governor, 2 report to health, 3 report to labor, and 1 to the compensation board. In other words, the 11 are now divided into 4 different, they report to 4 different sources. Whereas under the bill, all 4 will report to one source, Director Commerce.
But the personnel that presently serve on those licensing boards, would they just come over to the Department of Commerce?
They would not be disturbed. Under the bill, the Director of Commerce, with the approval of the governor, no change there, appoints these boards. I mean the boards that we have now, sir. Well, the new boards, too. And from then on, after that board is appointed, the board itself selects its own personnel. You see what I mean, sir?
Yes, sir.
In other words, each board would have an executive secretary, and the executive secretary would probably have 2 or 3 on his or her staff. The Director of Commerce would have nothing to do with that, which I think is proper.
Is this spelled out in the bill itself?
Yes, sir. I didn't see it. Yes, it's spelled out there.
Lee, do you have any questions, Mr. Rubin? Will you repeat again from my own information? Of these 11 new boards, 5 report to governor, 3 report to labor, and 3 report to whom?
2 report to health, sir.
2.
And 1 to the compensation board. I can give you the breakdown if
you wish. That's fine. All right, sir. You have a table big enough to accommodate 25, do you?
Yes, sir. Down in the, we're in the Commerce Building, and we have a hearing room down there. Space about like this. In my own office, we can get 15 around the table, not quite 25.
All right, sir. No more questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Rubin. Ernest Moore.
Same amendment, roughly, for Section 9, 10, 11, and 12. We're asking that prior to or in front of each of these sections, we insert the words except as otherwise provided by law. Some of the language where it talks about the banking board and real estate board, we feel this would further clarify that and eliminate any possible conflict there might be in describing what the board may or may not do. Also, I think this would take care of any new functions that are both in the legislature now that are proposed for the Department of Commerce. Section 14, page 7, line 32. Back up in section 13 on page 7. We're asking the board, or that the word committee in that section be changed to board. I think that's a typographical error. And then section 14 on the same page, line 32, says the director of commerce, with the approval of the governor, shall appoint an advisory board. That might better be changed to may. Some of these functions that can at a later date be transferred into the department just may not have to have an advisory board. And if one is not necessary, I don't think we should go to the expense of setting one up. And also in section 14 on the following page, page 8, line 1. Just for clarification, we're asking that after the word activity, we insert within the Department of Commerce. That would mean these licensing boards, the only ones we're talking about are within the Department of Commerce. There could be maybe an issue raised that with some of the other boards that aren't affected by that language.
page six, or page nine, section 16. It talks about approval of the claims by the various boards. As such, now I think most of these boards, the executive secretary signs the routine claims. And we're asking that after the word chairman, we put in there or administrator. That should take care of that. Page 44, section 77. Line 17, there was a another typo area. We're changing the word amounts to accounts. Then in section 80, we're merely adding some language in there to allow the Consumer Services Division to become operative on July 1. For further clarification, the other two pages of that thing you're looking at list the existing functions within the department and the added functions that Mr. Ludeman talked about. I would like to give you just a bit more history on the consumer services part of this bill. We have a statement there. President Nixon's Committee on Consumer Interest reported that at last count, 41 states had established some form of specifically designated consumer protection activities. These powers varied from merely an advisory function to actual enforcement of the various consumer protection laws. In January 1970, Jim Falstead stated that Governor McCall recognized the need for doing something in this area and established a task force. The function of this task force is to provide assistance to the consumers in resolving their complaints and formulate suggestions for new legislation and policy decision making. Literally hundreds of complaints were being received by the various state agencies that involved matters outside of regulatory powers and the jurisdictional control of the agencies. Oregon citizens were being shunted from pillar to post with only to be told ultimately that, you know, I'm sorry, we can't help you. I think we've gone some direction in changing that now. Since its inception, the task force has handled over 1,000 complaints, and about 80% of these, as you've heard from Kirby's testimony, have been handled in favor of the consumer. And I'd like to say that these are very real, valid complaints. They are to the people that are complaining about them. The complaints that do involve existing agencies are routed directly to the other agency for handling. We just merely log it, forward it on, and tell the person who's complaining about it that we have done so, and they'll be contacted by the other agency. Right now, the task force doesn't have any funds, and has been told to you that all of the work is being done on a volunteer basis, evenings and weekends. And we have recently been quite fortunate to get the services of an intern student from Willamette to assist us in handling these complaints. Salem housewife has volunteered to help with it. She comes in one day a week and goes through the backlog of all the complaints, trying to get these squared away and follow up, find out satisfaction, whether or not the complaint was handled, if we weren't notified. Attached to this statement, you'll find statistics on as to the number and type of complaints handled, and also some copies of some recent thank you letters that people have appreciated what we've done. In addition, the Management 70s Task Force, when they were studying the Department of Commerce, recommended the creation of a consumer services division. You have a copy of that. Their recommendation that came out of this document. And also, as you're aware, the House Task Force and Governmental Reorganization has recommended the establishment of this function. I'd just like to conclude by saying that I believe the Consumer Services Task Force has been a success and has provided a very real needed function to the Oregon consumer. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I think you've done a fine job, too, on the Consumer Services, Mr. Moore. My question has to do with licensing, and perhaps you can answer it. If a woman in Ontario, say, wanted to receive a license, a beautician's license, would she have to travel to Salem to do this? Or what is the intent of the Department of Commerce if they have this responsibility?
Right now, our building, without some major remodeling, would not take additional people. It couldn't move at this time or in the foreseeable future. Anybody, except a few, we could remodel and get a few people in. And I believe it would be our plan until a building was available that we could house all of the licensing would be transferred by this act. Another part, they would stay right where they are. Right now, I don't know if you're aware, but if you want to talk to somebody from the Board of Optometry, you have to go to Milton Freeway.
If you live in Pendleton, that's not bad.
If you live in Pendleton, it's terrible.
Thank you. Lee? Ernie, just what is your connection now with the Department of Commerce?
I'm Director of Administrative Services for the department.
And this is a part of Commerce now because the governor set up the Consumer Task Force and...
Yes, the governor appointed Mr. Ludeman, Director of Department of Commerce. Sam Haley, Public Utilities Commissioner, and Walter Lapp, Director of Agriculture. They looked around for somebody to do it. The task fell upon me.
Is there any duplication of effort by you and the President Ombudsman?
No, there isn't. We trade complaints back and forth. He sends me his consumer complaints, and I send him any complaints I get against governmental agencies. We do work quite closely, as also we do with the Attorney General.
I guess I better not ask you for any editorial comment then on the validity of the Ombudsman's office. I don't have any more questions for you. We appreciate very much your testimony. We'll take these amendments under consideration. Thank you very much. Laverne S. Miller of Portland.
Line 30, after waste, delete.
with a comma, and then the same line after drainage, insert and. And page 30, line 31, delete and sewage disposal installation. On page 31, after line 14, insert. 3, the board shall, in accordance with ORS 183.330, adopt amend and repeal rules which prescribe minimum standards for sewage cesspool work, including septic tanks and disposal fields, cesspool and dry wells, sewage pumping equipment, tank surface identification, tank surface workmen, and disposal of septic tanks and cesspool sludge. And to make this compatible with the suppressed fee or the licensing, ORS 447.030 would have to be amended so that the Department of Commerce would receive the income from the commerce, the Board of Health would receive the income from the food cesspool operators. Then 447.090 would have to be amended so that the commerce code account would then become the account of the Department of Commerce, and the fees received 447.033 would be paid into the Board of Health and placed upon the Board of Health account for administration of that program. Any questions?
I don't think there are, Mr. Miller. I think we'll have to absorb your suggested amendments. Ed, you don't have any questions.
Have you had any reaction on this proposal from the plumbers union and the plumbers themselves?
Plumbing is one of the programs within the division, and I've had no reaction from the standpoint of opposing or supporting.
Okay, thank you very much. Dwayne Anderson, Oregon State Board of Health. Switch that microphone around a little bit. I don't think we're doing too good on it.
I'm Dwayne Anderson, supervisor of the Communicative Disorders Programs at Oregon State Board of Health. I'm speaking specifically about the hearing aid use exception.
About which?
10.62.
The what section?
Hearing aid dealers. During the 1959 Bargain legislative session, an act requiring registration of all selling and dealing hearing aids was passed. This statute was historic since it was the first of such legislation ever passed by any legislative body, provided for some control over sales practices of individuals dealing in hearing aids. Protection of the public was the underlying basis for passage of this law. The advertising and sales practices of hearing aid dealers was so flagrant within the state that a general public outcry was heard asking for some form of protection. It was with true foresightedness that prior to the current ATAL Act of Consumer Protection, or enacted into law legislation of type. Years since, inquiries have come from almost every state and province of Canada requesting information about how does it work, does it work, etc. Extensive data has been submitted to two major investigations into the hearing aid industry by the United States Senate. In 1967, the Council of State Governments submitted almost word for word Oregon's hearing aid dealers bill as a model act to be considered for state legislation. It was not until 1967 that the second state passed the Hearing Aid Dealers Registration Act. Now there are about 25 states which have such legislation. And the vast majority of them have used Oregon's law as a model. The modifications that were made in the Hearing Aid Dealers Act and incorporated in House Bill 1062 make substantial changes in Oregon's law. It appears that these modifications are to remain as they have been written. The Oregon Hearing Aid Dealers Law will in fact be changed from a regulation for the protection of the public eventually result in protection of the commercial interests of the hearing aid industry. As it now stands, the powers and duties which were originally given to the Oregon State Board of Health will now be turned over to the State Board of Hearing Aid Audiologists, which is made up of a majority of hearing aid dealers. It is imperative that this section allowing the administration of the Act be carried out by previously, which was formerly only an advisory board, be changed. It has been previously acknowledged by Representative Martin that the use of the term audiologist is inappropriate for the use of this particular statute, and this term will be removed. If the existing provision in ORS 694 could be transferred exactly to the Department of Commerce, it would seem that the original objective of consolidating licensing activities within one agency could be met. It is highly doubtful, however, that such a transfer would be economically feasible if administration is to be carried out at a level at which is currently being maintained with the Oregon State Board of Health. At the present time, the Registration Act is self-supporting with the income from the application and renewal fees. This amounts to approximately $7,500 each year. Out of this amount, money is paid to support a part-time administrator and secretary, along with overhead expenses such as rent, administration, examination, etc. Fortunately, the Oregon State Board of Health carries on a statewide hearing conservation program, and within this section, the Licensing Act is administered most economically. If one full-time employee were hired to carry out the provisions of the Licensing Act, it is doubtful that the annual budget of approximately $7,500 could be maintained, and it's likely that it would result in a budget at least double that amount. It is recognized that the current regulations relating to hearing aid dealers do not exert a great deal of restriction on advertising and sales practices. Instead of reducing this control, as occurs in House Bill 1062, it is hoped that a more comprehensive consumer protection provision be considered. Only a few modifications of ORS 694, an act of considerable protection for public, could be written. A copy of the suggested bill with these modifications is attached, and I have those available for the committee. I have also a statement from Norton Young from the University of Oregon Medical School, who is chairman of the current Governor's Advisory Committee to the State Board of Health and Hearing Aid. Would you like to hear that? I would like to express my strong concern regarding House Bill 1062 as it pertains to the licensing and supervision of hearing aid dealers in the state. The shifting of this function to the State Department of Commerce and other details of the pending bill will have an adverse effect on the functioning of the original hearing aid licensing law. This law was aimed at the protection of the hearing impaired public from the scrupulous hearing aid dealers and an upgrading of the performance of the dealers in the state. Moving the implementation of this law from the State Board of Health, in which it was functioning well, and adding additional hearing aid dealers to the advisory board will weaken the already minimal protection the law affords. I therefore urge that House Bill 1062, as written, not be passed and the current hearing aid licensing bill be strengthened. Norton B. Young, Chairman. Those are my two statements.
You say you have amendments for this section?
I have a copy of
it. Do you have any objection to placing the hearing aid dealers in the Department of Commerce?
No.
The word audiologist, do you want to go into that a little bit?
I think that my partner here will speak next, and they could answer that very straightforwardly.
Your partner? I thought you were...
Well, Jim Maurer,
Okay, I'm trying to... Do you have any questions, Ed Lee? We'd appreciate having a copy of your testimony, and we'll call on your partner, quote. Mouser?
My work as
clinical audiologist at Portland State University and at Providence Medical Center, has for the past 6 years involved testing of hearing handicapped adults and children. This involves a number of complex measures of human hearing and its climax when surgery or medical rehabilitation is contraindicated by a hearing aid evaluation. This means that I have relatively close contact with a number of hearing aid dealers to whom I refer patients. And I'd like to say at the onset that I have a deep respect for reputable dealers who have earnestly and honestly sought solutions to the handicap of deafness. Most of the patients that I see are over 60 years of age. Hearing tends to degenerate with age, and in the society we're living in. And a part of this is what disturbs me about the House bill under consideration. It establishes an identity between what I, as a certified clinical audiologist, am doing, providing a senior citizen with appropriate hearing rehabilitation in a medical setting, and the services performed by individuals whose main income is derived from hearing aid sales. The term audiologist, as encompassed by definitions publicly ascribed to by the National Association of Speech and Hearing Agencies, the American Speech and Hearing Association, the Oregon Speech and Hearing Association, by Medicare and the Veterans Administration and other agencies, clearly establishes by ethical code and professional demeanor an individual who holds at least a master's in audiology or hearing sciences and who may not engage in the selling of any product, including hearing aids. One whose interest, by his lack of commercial bias, clearly reflects the patient's welfare. So it disturbs me that a contingency of Oregon hearing aid dealers should suddenly wish to identify with audiology by using this professional designation. It disturbs me that some dealers should feel that the label hearing aid dealer is not sufficient to describe the activities of these businessmen, and I seriously question the motive underlying the requested change. Last year, the Business Beat column of the Eugene Register Guard newspaper informed the public of a new process for evaluating hearing aids. According to the optician running the show, this new process allows hearing aids to be tailored to each individual's needs. Operating the equipment, the article states, is a certified audiologist. During the testing, and I quote, the individual wears a master hearing aid in both ears while an audiologist sends to it electronic signals of various frequencies. Perhaps not relevant to the intent of this group that we discuss such misleading statements as appeared in this article, but what is interesting is that the term certified audiologist and audiologist were used interchangeably. The individual in question is not listed among those practicing audiologists in the directory of the American Speech and Hearing Association. I have a deep respect for the contributions of reputable hearing aid dealers, but I seriously question whether the use of the term audiologist in any context is not an attempt to gain status, perform tasks, and undertake responsibilities for which they may not be qualified. There are still hearing aid salesmen in Oregon who fail to correct naive clients who refer to them as, quote, doctor, who wear white coats, who engage in deceptive advertising, whose salesmen engage in high-pressure door-to-door sales tactics, such as your hearing will get worse if you don't buy my hearing aid, or who misrepresent either the product or the reputable dealer's policy. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm frankly tired of seeing elderly persons who are on Social Security with limited financial funds who have collected 3, 4, 5 hearing aids that are useless to them in their dresser drawers, involving investments of hundreds of dollars in false promises, who are being victimized by bush-beating salesmen. I think it's time that reputable Oregon dealers assume the responsibility for the business practices of all individuals who engage in hearing aid sales. And until such time as this transpires, I would urge for more tighter legislative controls than those reflected by House Bill 1062. Further, I respectfully submit to you that dealers should not constitute a quorum in the administration of hearing aid policies, but rather a separate agency of non-commercial interests should be composed to assume this responsibility for provisions of the Act.
both for the protection of the general public and reputable professional dealers.
Thank you very much. Other questions of Mr. Marshall?
You talk about being victimized. Are you talking about Oregonians, or are you talking about a national scandal, or?
I only speak to the state of Oregon.
State of Oregon. Are you an audiologist?
I am an audiologist.
Are you licensed by the state, or is there any certification that's
certified by the American Speech and Hearing Association? I'm also engaged in the training of audiologists.
So your testimony is more contrary to what the previous gentleman had to say.
No. I support the measure that he has introduced.
He expressed that Oregon's laws were model laws and that had been copied by numerous other states.
That's true. Historically, they were vintage. It was a vintage law, which provided restrictions, but at this day and age, we need greater restrictions, more control, both for the benefit of reputable dealers and for the public at large.
So just to strengthen this portion with this part of the bill, is what you're after, right?
That's correct.
Have you read the amendments Mr. Anderson has proposed?
Yes.
And you agree with those amendments?
I am supportive of those.
What is the present designation of the hearing aid dealers in the present Oregon law?
Hearing aid audiologists, according to...
No, I don't mean in 1062. I mean in the Oregon ORS of now.
I think that's hearing aid dealers.
Hearing aid dealers.
Yeah. Hearing aid dealers. This is a
big pardon?
This.
Yes, I realize this trip. Thank you very much, Mr. Meyer. Frank Smith, are you in Salem all the time?
Frank Smith, the Occupational Health Section, State Board of Health. I'm not speaking necessarily for or against this bill, just to it. The most clarifying section on mobile home construction standards appears in 1062. There are currently under consideration by this committee three bills related to construction standards in mobile homes. House Bill 1048 would create a building code provision and assume administration of mobile home standards relating to plumbing, heating, and electrical equipment. They would also administer safety glazing regulations under 447150. House Bill 1400, also before this committee, would amend 447150 to extend safety glazing requirements to mobile homes. Now, House Bill 1062 would place current mobile home construction standards under the Department of Commerce with current regulations under ORS 446155 and following be administered by that agency. Under provisions of House Bill 1048 and 1062, there is no recognition of the need for safety glazing to protect occupants of mobile homes against accidental human impact with sliding doors, etc. Under Sections 49 and 50 and Sections 52 and 3 of 1062, mobile home construction standards, an amendment is encouraged, which I haven't suggested, but it could do so, to require glazing and glass that meet nationally recognized standards, rather than being concerned only with the current plumbing, heating, and electrical requirements. The issuance of any insignia designating compliance with minimum safety standards relating to structural components, as provided
provided in this or other bills relating to mobile home construction must include provisions for safety glazing at least equivalent to the proposed amendment to the National Standards Institute A119.1 standard for mobile homes, section 8.5, glass and glazing. I simply wanted to call this to your attention, realizing that this and other proposed bills are dealing with this problem. The committee's attention is also called to Senate Bill 298 and 244, in which the Senate Labor and Industries Committee is considering mobile home construction standards, including the application of safety glazing requirements. Such provisions as should be accomplished under this or other bills has been included in this testimony, which I will be with you on. Other questions, Mr. Chairman?
Isn't that glazing and glass taken care of in that Senate bill to which you refer, one of them?
244 would place all mobile home construction standards under the Labor Commissioner. They would adopt the American National Standards Institute standard A119.1, which relate to mobile homes. Now, there is currently a proposed amendment to this standard, which would include safety glazing. However, if the standard were adopted by legislation or by the agency responsible for regulating, as it now stands, then it would not include safety glazing because it is still in the balloting situation and is now being considered, I believe, by the American Fire Protection Association. We'll vote on it in May. If they're approved, it will go back to the National Standards Institute for inclusion. As of now, it is not. And if either of the Senate bills referred to would in fact take into account this proposed amendment, then it would be covered. Yes, I am in receipt of correspondence from Mrs. Reed, who copies to, et cetera, which I hope will respond to and explain this a little more.
House Bill 1400 was before this committee, and she told us that we need no longer consider it as being taken care of elsewhere.
Yes, this is what I wanted to respond to also. As I have explained, it would be taken care of if a proposed amendment were considered. But I can give you no details on that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. May, are you from Minnville? Is that what this said? Macy, I mean? Macy, yes.
Representative Ingalls and members of the committee, my name is Glenn Macy, and I'm president of the Oregon State Board of Funeral Directors and Embalmers. We do not object to House Bill 1062 as such, but we do object to Section 34, which includes the funeral directors and embalmers in that bill. In that, the Board of Funeral Directors and Embalmers is basically a health-related agency. One of our major concerns is the protection of public health. All of our laws, rules, and regulations under which we operate are tied to that one concern. We are tied closely with the present Board of Health with regard to the filing of forms, such as the report of deaths, which we have to do in each and every case, death certificates. Responsibility of the funeral director to file that report, and a portion of that death certificate has to be signed, the medical portion has to be signed by the doctor involved. That is filed and ends up the State Board of Health, and when a family needs a certified copy for many, many reasons, insurance for example, that certificate is secured from the Department of Health. And if the funeral director is late in filing that report, or there's something wrong with the content of the report, then the Department of Vital Statistics, of which Ms. Marion Martin is the head, and we've already talked with her and she agrees with our thinking, she can call our office, and we in turn will get hold of the defending funeral director and get the matter straightened
Department of Commerce and move to Salem, for example, then it would, might even necessitate even to a hearing to get that fuel director, to get that situation straightened out. The inspection of the funeral homes. We inspect the funeral homes in this state at least once a year by law, and it's directed toward the embalming portion of that funeral home where it's concerned with the protection of the public health and communicable disease. I might itemize for you at this time, for your clarification, what an applicant for an embalmer's license in this state has to take at the state board examination to support our theory. He has to be approved, and he has to be fully informed and passed examination in the theory and practice of embalming, anatomy, pathology, bacteriology, hygiene, including sanitation and public health, chemistry involving toxicology, restorative art, including plastic surgery and demisurgery, and mortuary law. You can see six out of those seven subjects are involved directly with the Department of Public Health as such. For the past many years, we have been under the administrative jurisdiction of the Public Health, of the Board of Health, with regard to business management, general services, personnel, through which we receive assistance with our budgets, office supplies, machines, use of Board of Health equipment, and most of our activities are health regulated, such as our rules regarding the transportation of the dead, requirements for holding funerals, care of dead human bodies, and so forth. We certainly have no objection to 1062, but we feel, and definitely feel, that you should remove Section 34 and put us in with the Department of Human Resources, because we are basically a health-related organization. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. Are there any questions of the committee? We're having further work sessions on the Department of Health bill, and we'll consider them together.
Incidentally, Representative Ingalls, I've had close cooperation with Mr. Paul Stitch on, I've been president of the state board for 2 years, and Jim has come to me twice on specific complaints involving funeral directors, and we've been able to get that particular situation straightened out at the time. We don't feel there's any conflict or any problem involved. Where we are now, which is basically under the Department of Health.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. Eugene P. Diller. Eugene. I noticed Bill William Hill is on here, too. Are you together? And then
yes, sir. I had hoped to testify after him.
Well, he's from Salem, and I'm trying to get the people from out of town taken care of first. If
I'm Eugene DiLoretto, president of the Engineers and Architects Council of Oregon. The coordinating council for the various engineering and architectural societies in Oregon. In this group represents some 13 engineering societies. What we are objecting to in Bill 1062 is the section of the bill that permits the director of the Department of Commerce to regulate the size of the board, particularly the engineering board. There are now some 14 disciplines that the engineering board supervisor licenses for. There is also a proposed bill before the Senate that fixes the number of this board at 9. I believe that the most I can say is that when Mr. Hill does testify, the Engineers and Architects Council of Oregon does endorse his testimony.
Can you point out exactly where you are?
Yes, sir. It's section 17.
What page is that?
It's page 9, lines 5 to 8.
I as I recall, that's more or less to standardize the board membership. How many members do you have now?
There are 9 on the Board of Engineering Examiners.
Well, it says not more than 9 in here.
Yes, sir. It also says that from 3 to 9,
mm-hmm.
and it does, as I understand it, give the department director the prerogative of reducing the size of the board to 3, should he desire.
Well, that isn't in the intent of the bill. The intent of the bill was to more or less standardize these because some didn't have enough and some had over 9, and we just wanted them within this range, but we weren't intending that the head of the department would reduce the existing board if there were 9.
I may have misinterpreted it.
Well, it's not your fault. Do you have any objection to being included in the department other than the under the, this section?
No, sir. They're now presently included in the department.
Okay. You're okay. Check the wording on that to make sure it's fair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glenn McDaniel from Portland.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Glenn McDaniel. I'm the chairman of the State Board of Accountants. Two brief observations to make about the bill. Section 16, which provides that the revenues of the board shall be placed in the general fund, causes us some concern, notwithstanding the provision that payments in the general fund shall constitute a continuing appropriation for the benefit of the board. Our concern is that this could be a step in the direction of making fees charged to professional accountants available for general fund purposes. We realize that the way the bill now reads that this is not possible. The only other observation we would like to make is that we are opposed to the authority of the Director of Commerce to fix the number of members in the board. Perhaps we have misread that one too. Concern is that we think it unwise that the Director of Commerce have the authority to have the discretion of changing the size of boards, lest this be an invitation to change the number of members of the board for some improper use. You understand we have no concern about the present Director of Commerce for the operation of the Department of Commerce. One other observation is that we have some objection to the fixing of a 3-year term for members of boards, thinking that where boards have 4 or 5 members, if the terms are 2 years and equal the number of members, it makes it easy to have an annual rotation by the appointment of one member each year, which we believe is beneficial to the board.
How many are there on your board now?
There are 5 members of our board.
And they serve 5-year terms?
No, they do not. But this is something that we think would be advantageous to us if the term of the state board were 5 years, so we'd have one new member each year. I would like to say that Mr. George Wendell is in the room, and he is on the legislative committee of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and that he concurs with our comments that I just made.
This section was kind of boilerplated, and we'll work it over to make sure everybody's happy with it. I hope.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Bert, we'll leave you for a while. Are you still here? Yeah. And Mr. O'Donnell from Portland.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mark O'Donnell from Portland, and I'm one of the attorneys who represent the Trader Coach Association, which is concerned with the mobile home recreational vehicle and factory-built housing industry. I brought with me
give you a little background of how our industry works and how we get our products approved in the state of Oregon, you might just briefly look at a plant approval application which is being distributed to you. And as you know, there's three agencies that regulate our industry at this time: the Bureau of Labor, the Board of Health, and the State Fire Marshal. The Bureau of Labor is really the administrative key here. They administer the whole program in that the application goes to them first, they approve it or disapprove it, they pass it on to the Board of Health, and then the Board of Health eventually turns it over to the Fire Marshal, who in turn either approves or disapproves it. All the fees are paid into the Bureau of Labor, and they administer the program. They keep all the records. They have various other functions. They distribute the money to the Board of Health and the State Fire Marshal after they deduct their administrative costs. Now, if anything's wrong with a plan, if there's something wrong with a plan, each separate agency, whichever one is involved, if it's a plumbing problem, of course, then the Board of Health would go ahead and handle that on their own. Basically, what we wind up with are three agencies and three enforcement programs over the common product of mobile homes and recreational vehicles. The varying level of the agencies, the performance level of the three agencies varies, but all in all, their problems, at least from an industry standpoint, are caused by the lack of central authority in one agency or one head, and as opposed to this distribution of three different agencies to deal with. The fire marshal's jurisdiction is basically whenever there's any gas appliance or gas system in a mobile home or recreational vehicle, then he has jurisdiction there. The Board of Health, of course, is for plumbing fixtures, and the Bureau of Labor is for electrical. I won't go into all the problems. I'll just illustrate one to you.
Excuse me just a moment, Mark. The testimony you've handed out is in relation to House Bill 1048.
Well, that was going to be my conclusion. Since these bills do overlap, I thought I should bring that up. And I just wanted to take care of that now. I wanted to provide the committee with a copy of our analysis of House Bill 1048. And why we're supporting this bill and we're not supporting 1048. And the purpose of the printed analysis was not to take up your time here today, but to refer it to you for reading when you had the opportunity. I did distribute the amendments.
Yes, we have the amendments. We can get a copy of them.
One problem I'd just like to illustrate is a visual, what we call visual inspection in the industry. If a manufacturer or a dealer needs to have a product, mobile home or recreational vehicle, looked at and inspected on his lot or at the building site, at the place of manufacture, he'll call the Bureau of Labor or write him a letter and say, would you please come out and inspect this? And he's charged $11 per hour for each man hour that's actually spent. And he's entitled to have this inspection in 5 days under the rules and regulations that are promulgated by the three agencies. An example of a recent inspection which was brought to my attention by one of my dealer members was two agencies charged 1 hour and one agency charged 4 hours. And as far as he could determine and I could determine, there was no reason for it. We don't mind paying fees. We do think that a central authority, the central inspection, could eliminate some of the excessive costs. We have no statistics, of course, as to if it would be cheaper, but we think so. In the state of Washington, we have one department there that regulates this. That's the Department of Labor and Industry. And for plan approval, they have expertise in three different areas. And in other words, they have a structural engineer or someone with a plumbing background or electrical background to analyze the plans. In field inspection, though, they're kind of going to what they call the triple threat inspector, or the person with the background. Usually he has an electrical background, and they
trim and plumbing and the other facets of inspection, and he can go out and make many of these visual inspections by himself rather than having three agencies out here. In 1969, in this legislature, we greatly increased the fees that for the plan approval and for the insignia program. Every mobile home or recreational vehicle that's sold in, in Oregon or offered for sale has to have a little insignia attached to it stating that it meets the rules and regulations of this state. In 1970, there were about 68 mobile homes offered for sale and I think 14,000 recreational vehicles. The fees were increased, of course, to give us a meaningful or to assist the agencies in carrying out a meaningful enforcement program. And under the first 10 months of the program, our industry paid in about $208,000 for plan approval and insignia fees. And we project conservatively that for 2 years, a 2 year period starting March 1, 1970, when the new law became, the new fee schedule, I should say, became effective, that there will be approximately $450,000 paid in on this program. With the passage of Senate Bill 188 and the Mobile Home Construction Standard Code, which Senate Bill 188 is a factory built housing bill, this is included here in one of my amendments, and we would like, if you're going to take in everything in the Department of Commerce, we would like the factory built housing and also the Mobile Home Construction Standard Program, which under these two bills are vested, or the authority is given to the Bureau of Labor. We'd like these transferred over to the Department of Commerce also. We expect the fees under there in the first biennium to be somewhere in the nature of $170,000. The amendments that I have proposed, the first four amendments, I discussed the fifth already. The first four amendments are basically on pages 26 through 29 of the bill. And the bill in its present form reads that the Department of Commerce shall have take over the functions of the Board of Health and the Labor Commissioner. And yet it leaves to the Fire Marshal the promulgation of rules and codes, and I believe a certain end inspection. We think that these agencies are going to be put in the, as I get it, the concept of the 25-member table. We'd like the 25th member to be, to have all, not only the rulemaking authority, but we'd also like them to have the inspection authority. If we leave it into one agency, in other words, if we put the fire marshal regulatory authority over mobile homes in the 26th slot, or in another slot of this table, I don't think we're accomplishing what we're trying to accomplish here, which is protection to the people of this state without excessive duplication and a higher cost through enforcement fees. And I hope that you will seriously consider that amendment. I see no reason why the fire marshal is left in the program. I know the bill takes him into the Department of Commerce, but I don't want to have a problem 3 years from now and call up the man who will write to him and run the 25th head of this department and have him say, well, the fire marshal, you know, the fire marshal, that's kind of his jurisdiction, that's his problem. We'd like to clearly define the lines of the authority for rulemaking and for inspection. This could all be handled through the Department of Commerce.
This is what will happen. Are there any questions of Mr. O'Donnell? Thank you very much. The last witness on this page is PHCC and OCIC, and I don't know whether you're Salem or Portland.
Both.
You're both. Well, in all fairness, I should start up with the other Salem people then. Mr. Hill.
Here
member.
Yes, nine members.
No problem.
Senate Bill 44, which is proposed for establishment, has a number of... Primarily, this is our statement concerning 1062, where we're satisfied with the provisions of that.
Thank you very much, sir. Bruce Judson.
Representing Ingles Bay, Mr. Person, well, it does live in Portland as far as traffic is concerned. I can be here Wednesday if you want to call in.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. How long are you going to be, Bert? How long are you going to take? Request. thank you very much. Mr. Skaggs, can you speak for your entire group?
Well, I think so.
Okay, that's KAGGN. Oh, that was,
I'm Warren D. Skaggs, I'm president of the Oregon Society of Hearing Aid Consultants. As far as your Bill 1062 is concerned, we were quite disturbed, let's put it that way, when we first heard of being moved out of the Department of Health into a new Department of Commerce. But we attended the meeting down here before at Chairman Engel's request. As we requested to be here, he heard us. They convinced us during that time that perhaps we would be just as well off, or maybe a little better off, to conduct our business and to serve the hard of hearing people in the state of Oregon if we were moved out of the Department of Health into the new Department of Commerce. Mr. Maurer and Mr. Anderson have testified before us, seem to put a lot of emphasis on the word audiologist. If you'll recall, Chairman Engels, when we first came down here, the original writing of this bill was Board of Audiologists. We felt this was wrong. We don't want to infringe on those people's name. But we pointed out to the board at that time that we are, many of us, certified as hearing aid audiologists nationally. As hearing aid audiologists, not audiologists. This was taken under advisement evidently at that time because it was rewritten into the House bill that was sent to us that we were to be called hearing aid audiologists. A little history on that. There's a National Society of Hearing Aid Audiologists, and they do not call themselves that. They are the National Society of Hearing Aid Consultants. But under their National Society charter, they have permission to use the name hearing aid audiologist for their members who are certified nationally, which means basically that they have studied and take further testing in order to perform certain duties in accordance with their board. Now, as far as the name's concerned, and we people in the industry, we could care less what we're called. We feel our basic reason in this business is to serve the hard of hearing people. And as far as the name is concerned, I think we'll continue to do the job that most of us have been doing, regardless of what comes out in the bill. This time now, there are 23 certified hearing aid audiologists in the state of Oregon, with 20 more now being processed at a national level. So we are given permission at a national level to use the word hearing aid audiologist in Yellow Page Directory if so stated that we are certified nationally with the same act. Regarding the number of board members that one of the gentlemen mentioned, at this time, the governor's board, we have 3 hearing aid dealers that's on the governor's board. There is 1 audiologist and 1 doctor. This is the same situation that was intended in the new bill. I think if we were doing anything at this time to try to disrupt or run the affairs of the State Board of Health, that this governor's board at this time would not be such as it is. Back when the law was first initiated in 1960, there was 93 of us that took the first test that was put together by the audiologists and the State Board of Health. Out of those 93, if I recall, there was 67 that passed the first time, with the rest passed the second or third time around. Today in the state of Oregon, there are about 140 which are which are licensed by the State Board of Health. This to us seems that the state board itself is curtailing our operation and the fact that we cannot get the people out to actually serve the hard of hearing people. The state is large enough at this day and increasing every day that there should be possibly twice as many licensed in the state. But so far, we've never been able to attract the right kind of people to get them into the business. And we certainly are in agreement with the testing situation. Nobody has ever complained about the test that we had to take to become hearing aid dealers. There are 3 changes, however, in 1062 that we have written to Chairman Ingalls about. One is a reciprocal law with other states. Now, just this last week, Idaho became a licensed state. Washington is in the process right now of being licensed. It is our feeling that a reciprocal law should be in our bill, whereby that if they are licensed and recognized, that we should be able to reciprocate by giving them a license in this state if they pass their testing, and vice versa, if we should want to go into Washington or Idaho or California and work, that we should be recognized as with our law that we have. The second area of change that we've requested is a two-year apprenticeship program. Basically, this is to upgrade our industry. Many of us spend a lot of money and time to acquire new personnel and to train them into this business. But they cannot be trained in the 6 months length of time it takes to pass a state examination. If a man can crack books and can study, he can pass that in the first 6 months, but he knows nothing about rehabilitating the deputies or going out here and servicing these people. So we feel that a two-year apprenticeship is very important to upgrade the industry. Not changing anything that's now in your state law as far as the testing is concerned of the consultant, but to force him to stay under the apprenticeship of whoever starts him in the business for a period of at least 2 years until he can open his own shop. Now, we've had instances in this state where a man has came in to the State Board of Health, taken out a temporary permit, within 5 months was out in business for himself. The particular one I have in mind lasted 6 months in the business. He has maybe 100 people out there that he sold that are hanging loose now with no service. And he didn't have the actual know-how to keep himself in business. This is what we're trying to overcome. Other than that, the dealer in this state who takes it by himself to hire these people and train them is certainly entitled to get a little work out of him before he loses him to his own business. The third reason, or the third amendment to this bill, is in the pricing area. We feel it's very unfair to price an aid in a paper at any price when the advertising itself is deceptive, and possibly the aid would not be delivered at that price. There would be ear molds, batteries, and so forth involved in the complete sale, which would be charged for basically on top of the price. Or an ad that describes one hearing aid and says that the prices start at another figure. We have with us some ads that were taken from the paper I won't go into, but we feel that, again, pricing the hearing aid in the paper upsets the hard of hearing person, and the ones that are doing this practice are the ones who are selling medical supplies, they're selling glasses, they're selling drugs in many cases, drug stores. In other words, they're not making their livelihood from the selling and serving of the hard of hearing. If you will take these under consideration for us, we'd appreciate very much, and as I stated before, we're not opposed to being changed into a new Department of Commerce, but we would like a couple of changes made in our favor at this time. Thank you, Chairman.
I have amendments for Mr. Hurt. Are those the ones to whom you refer?
Mr. Hurt, yes, he's my chairman of the... Yes.
I have a letter from you with suggested amendments.
Those are the amendments that Mr. Skaggs referred to.
Yes. Did you have something else to add, Mr. Hurt?
Mr. Skaggs covered it quite well. If you have any questions, you can answer it for us.
I think not. Do you... people object to being known as hearing aid consultants instead of audiologists?
No. When we came down here, sir, if you'll recall, you had the board of hearing aid or audiologists, and we said that that wasn't right.
Okay.
And we suggested that being there's 30 or 23 of us in the state that are now certified nationally, that certified hearing aid audiologists would be a more proper name for us. The other states are using it at the national level. That's exactly what they're called. Hearing aid audiologists, yes.
Okay. Yes.
May I ask a question? In the event that the name change is made on the bill, I think there should be
something added so that it would not eliminate the use of the name certified hearing aid audiologist by those members that have already obtained certification from the national level. And I can submit that in writing to you, and I have it here if you would like for me to read it.
I would appreciate it.
This is a provision we would like to have in here. Any hearing aid dealer or consultant that has passed the National Hearing Aid Society certification examination for hearing aid audiologists can use the wording in his hearing aid business as follows: certified hearing aid audiologist by the National Hearing Aid Society.
May I have a copy of that, Mr. Hunt? Lou, are you available to come back for a...
Yes, sir.
Okay, I think we'll close the hearing today on this measure. I appreciate you all coming. We'll have another hearing.